Sitting at the computer here, and I will facilitate later when the questions and answers come about during that time. So just two real brief announcements, and please mute if you haven't already. We want to thank you for joining us in an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those with sensitivities. And we just want to say that all of the activities here, well, are free and voluntary, time, money, and service. But we stress impersonality, which means we don't use first names. That's only to not distract from the teachings. So it's that's the way we do it here. And so we can certainly chat after the meetings, but during the meetings, it's kind of a formal atmosphere, which actually facilitates learning. So we don't talk about personalities or personal anecdotes or things like that. We don't do side talk or cross talk or whatever else. Strictly direct all comments to the chairperson. So I'm not the chairperson, and I will turn it over to the chairperson at this time.
Unmute, please.
Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists on Zoom or in Philadelphia. We will begin our meeting by a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part inside issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We welcome all again to our theosophical meetings, which we have open and free to the public, both in Philadelphia at 1917 Walnut and on Zoom. Our meetings are held every Sunday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, every Wednesday from 7:30 to 8:45, and on Fridays from 6:30 to 7:30. Now, this Sunday meeting, October the 27th, The overall topic is basic theosophical propositions. No, I'm sorry. That's November's overall topic. We are the fundamental principles. Now, what did I write down? I don't know what I wrote down. Oh, the object. Well, it's a theosophical movement and their objects. We think that's it, but I think we got that wrong again. But anyhow, this week we're talking about the three objects of the theosophical movement. Now, next Sunday, we're going to talk about the three fundamental principles of theosophy. There's a difference, and we will point that out this morning. On Wednesday, we have finished chapter one in The Ocean of Theosophy, and we are beginning chapter two, The Evolution of the Cosmos. And we are doing, as promised, as theosophists, beginning from universals and going to go to particulars. So you're welcome to come join us to begin this journey from the universal to the particular. And then on Friday evenings, this October 27th, we are probably going to be looking at chapter three, but that has not become official yet. But if we are logical, we did two, I guess we'll do three next. Okay, so those are our subjects for the remainder of the month. Now in November, we are going to be going over basic theosophical propositions for that entire month. Okay, now we are going to have a forum this morning where someone's going to present a short talk on this morning, the three objects of the theosophical movement. And then we'll leave it open for questions and conversation and comments. Go ahead, please.
Okay. It was at New York City in 1875 when the Theosophical Society was formed. H.P. Blavatsky associated with William Q. Judge and Henry Steele Olcott and others defined its three objects, which covered its field of endeavor. These founders were obviously extremely careful to name these three as objects, not objectives. Realizing that objectives are changeable from time to time, like goals or perhaps New Year's resolutions, whereas the objects of an organization are its purpose, its motive for existing, its unchanging, absolute reason for being. So what are these three unwavering, steadfast, and resolute objects of the theosophical movement? The first is to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. The second is the study of ancient and modern religions, philosophies, and sciences, and the demonstration of the importance of such study. The third and last object is the investigation of the unexplained laws of nature and the psychical powers latent in man. So let's take a look at these one by one and just a quick brush. Have you ever thought that the first object was just an assemblage of words? An impossible ideal to realize? If so, listen to these words of H.P. Blavatsky, and I quote, "You were not directed to found and realize a universal brotherhood, but to form the nucleus for one. For it is only when the nucleus is formed that the accumulations can begin that will end in future years, however far in the formation of that body which we have in view. Has that nucleus been formed? Let no one answer from within the pale of any separate and separative organization, for the nucleus must be formed on quite a different basis. The first object, in fact, in its widest meaning, its full application, in other words, similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, the aim is one, to form the nucleus, setting aside everything that stands in the way of it, for they are, in reality, non-essentials. The purpose is one, to study, apply, and promulgate the one teaching of the teachers on the lines laid down so clearly, leaving foolish speculations to those who would pass over what is at hand and grasp at what they can neither hold, understand, or use. Brotherhood is not a sentiment. It is not emotion, nor yet is it so-called love. It is putting oneself mentally in the very place of another and realizing his difficulties while showing him that true compassion for which we hope in like place. Mental exercise in this direction helps to develop that power of the manus by means of which the adept projects his consciousness into that of the stone or of any other object in nature. Analogy and correspondence are the surest guides to an understanding of theosophy and the movement itself. Is there any between the three objects and the three fundamental principles? The first proposition relates to the source of all, compassion absolute. The masters are the bridge. Does not the first object give us the cue and guide to them, as well as the practice which brings us closer? And now the second object, the study of ancient and modern religions, philosophy, and sciences, and the demonstration of the importance of such study. This object must have its meaning, its purpose, and its lessons, but these cannot be found out or achieved in our mind has not ascended to the first object and been grounded and fortified in that arduous and uphill task through study and work of theosophy and humanity. The aim of the second object would then appear in part to be the leveling of the age-long barriers of creed, race, sex, caste, and color. For study of ancient and modern religions, philosophies, and sciences in the light of the fundamental propositions of theosophy and the fundamental object of the society would inevitably and infallibly show one source from whence have come the many religions and systems of thought. However, these may later have become polluted, adulterated, and overgrown with the rubbish of human invention and fantasy. No new knowledge can be imparted to humanity without affording a wider range of activity for those who are evilly disposed, and as selfishness, bigotry, spiritual blindness, and superstition still prevail among men, it is not to be wondered at that the false is taken for true and the truth is taken for false. had the warnings and advice of the original theosophy teachers had been heeded, much of this might have been avoided. For there then would have existed a strong corrective in the form of a universal united body of theosophists, whose unbroken font and unassailable motto, "There is no religion higher than truth," would have caught the attention of many thousands now entangled in the hopeless maze of Eastern eras, the karmic inheritance of those who asked, received, and failed to give. The pursuit of the second object would have been a hopeless task for the majority of Western students if the founders of the society had not provided ways and means for their benefit, and through them, for the world at large. In Isis Unveiled, published by H.P. Blavatsky in 1877, attention was drawn to the philosophy, religion, arts, and sciences bequeathed to prosperity by ancient India. In her secret doctrine, these were more specifically dealt with, as in many other articles from her pen, well known to theosophists and needing no special mention at this time. In America, the first Eastern work of importance to be placed in the hands of students was the Bhagavad Gita, a portion of the great epic poem of India known as the Mahabharata. We have William Q. Judge to thank for a complete retranslation from all the original renditions available at the time. This edition remains to this day the clearest and most readily comprehensible translation of this wonderful small book, the Bhagavad Gita. Additionally, Mr. Judge, in the furtherance of the second object, established the Oriental Department of the Theosophical Society, which issued pamphlets containing valuable translations from many from the Upanishads, which was an ancient collection of writings dealing with the origin of the universe, spirit and matter, and the nature of the human soul and ego. And so we come to the third object. The investigation of the unexplained laws of nature and the psychical powers latent in man. The mistake has been made by many, assuming that investigation means experimentation. Investigation belongs properly to the study of known laws and powers, for it is only when the student has thoroughly mastered the theory or science as given that he can wisely or safely begin to experiment. Excuse me. And as H.P. Blavatsky has written, what we have to do is to seek to obtain knowledge of all the laws of nature. To encourage the study of these laws, least understood by modern people, the so-called occult sciences, based on the true knowledge of nature, instead of, as at present, on superstitious beliefs based on blind faith and authority. It must be apparent then that a true knowledge of nature is necessary before any right effort can be made in direction of the third object. Theosophy, which embodies a record of the laws that govern the evolution of man and nature, has to be studied, assimilated, and applied to daily life before the student is in a position or condition to understand and apply the more recondite laws of the science. A grasp of the whole theory is wise and necessary, but practice should begin in our everyday relations, considered in the light of our real nature, and as this course is followed, the inner nature and perceptions are afforded fuller and freer range of action. With these considerations in mind, what is to be said of those who make claims to the possession of occult powers, who advertise themselves as adepts, initiates, and whatnot, or who circulate prospectuses of schools of occultism or claim to be magi, Rosicrucians, etc., etc.? An examination of the so-called instructions of those at present in existence shows much copying and rearrangement of matter accessible to anyone, and claims which have no basis in fact and cannot be substantiated. Fortunately for the world, the founders of the Theosophical movement left a record of theosophy pure and simple, and all necessary directions for its study and application in such a form as to be accessible to any who desire of it. There are those who follow this implicitly, and whose great desire and effort is that others may benefit as they have. In closing, please remember the motto of the Theosophical movement: there is no religion higher than truth. And if we were to expand on that, we would say there is no religion higher than, or there is no religion, philosophies, or sciences higher than truth. Once again, the topic for today is the three objects of the Theosophical movement.
Well, we've just had a very thoughtful presentation of the three objects of the Theosophical movement. Now, we have all come to Theosophy for varied reasons, but why? What would be the purpose for us joining or becoming part of an association such as Theosophy? Again, Theosophy is no organization, but it's an association of students. So in this association, how could we, or how can we, form a nucleus of universal brotherhood? SL?
Well, to go back to the first statement, that we come to Theosophy for many reasons, or many purposes, we would say that quite a few come because they have questions. They're not satisfied. They want answers, maybe to help solve the personal pain and struggle in their own life. Get more clarity there. Where does that kind of objective or purpose fit in with the overall three objects of the Theosophical movement? That were our aim.
Well, a nucleus of universal brotherhood. How is that? I think you're alluding to, how do you form that with the world as it is? One of our purposes is not for ourselves, is for others, is to be an aid for others. And so we have to be in sympathy with the struggles of others. We have to be in sympathy with the pain. And when we are in sympathy with that, because we have experienced it, we have all experienced pain and suffering. So to form that nucleus, we try to alleviate that pain. So that alleviation may come through a physical interaction, but it comes through a mental understanding of what that other person is going through, and being showing empathy and compassion. We see a few hands fluttering. ULT.
Go ahead.
Well, if we think of a universal, a nucleus of universal brotherhood, it would seem that a nucleus of something has to be at its core. You know, if we're all part of that nucleus, then we have to have all something in common at the core. So what would it be in this world of infinite diversity that we all actually have in common?
Well, that is the question. What is it that we all have in common? Well, we have our humanity in common. We are all human. And with that, again, compassion. And we need to study theosophy to gain spiritual knowledge. That spiritual knowledge has to open the heart so that the heart comprehends the wisdom that the mind is grasping, we're trying to grasp. We move amongst others, and what is remembered, sure, we are, as spoken of, we are all searching for answers for our own suffering, but for the suffering of the world, and how and what is the common basis for us to form that nucleus. In our declaration, the objects, study, work, these theosophical meetings that we hold, they're like a refuge in the currents of the world, because we're not looking at advancing the personality, we're looking at advancing the soul. And that means that the only way we can fully grasp the meaning of life is really by opening our heart. Yes, JCS.
Perhaps we need to visit a very ancient symbol, which is the point in the circle. That symbol is from the beginning of manifestation at the loftiest abstract basis, all the way down through each of us as soul operating through the human being. So the nucleus of universal brotherhood already exists. It is a fact in nature from the beginning of the cosmos until now. And as long as we're only looking without at the kaleidoscope of suffering and celebration around us, we're not in tune with that true essence, which is the nucleus of universal brotherhood, the point in the circle. So we need to turn within, to contemplate that, and to use that as a gold standard, so that as we look in the eyes of others, whether on Zoom or in person, we realize, we make real the fact that we all are radiance of that one point. And in that way, we strengthen the magnetic ties, and we're not distracted by the current horrors on the globe that we see around us.
Yeah, the comment has us to look within, for thou art Buddha. But again, I think the statement was pointing to the fact that within each and every one of us, there is that perceiver, that watcher, that one that sees the change and ever witnessed to the change. We are all that. All of us. And I think as was presented in our talk, is that the bigotry and the and racism and all that comes from the separateness that has grown up between religions and philosophies and understandings, and how we as theosophists have, pointing back to Ammonius Saccas and Porphyry and Proclus and Plato and Pythagoras. I mean, all of these ancient teachers or ideas are ancient. They're not a new invention. They've been carried forward for centuries. And that this idea of analogy and correspondence, especially now that we're starting in chapter two of our ocean classes, where we're looking at the cosmos, you know, we're getting the foundation for how we should perceive the world. You know, we all live in a world and we identify with it. That's how we have grown. We have identified, we've tried to improve it. We tried to, but we realize that we are not that which we see outside of us. What we are is really a ray, as was said, a ray of light, each one of us. And the realization of that is a life journey and putting that into practice. Yes, ULT.
Yes, universal brotherhood, which is includes everything, just like we talk about Manus being, that's man comes from Manus, the thinker. But of course, the soul is sexless. So just in case anybody's thinking, we wouldn't be forming universal brotherhood if it was just for brothers, would we now? So it's for brothers and sisters and everyone. So these are universal ideas. The language of English is the only one we have to work with now. Once upon a time, we spoke other languages, including Sanskrit, which is a great language. And one of the predictions is that Sanskrit will come back as a spoken language. And it's a much better language for expressing these ideas. So it's almost like we're using an axe instead of a fine carving knife. We need to carve away our distinctions, as it were. And that's universal brotherhood or personhood or whatever you want to call it. It's needed. It's sorely needed. And we're working on it, aren't we? I mean, we're really, as students, we do our best by study and otherwise to try to make these teachings accessible.
Yeah, I think, you know, that alludes to really the second object, is the study of Eastern literature, religions, science, and demonstrate the importance of that study. We at the Lodge try to encompass all of these objects in our study. Each month, we take up a topic. But everything, you know, theosophy can't really teach you anything. You have to want to understand it. And it's there for, because theosophy exists because we have brought it forth. We all have brought it forth. So now that we have it, how are we applying it in our life? And the objects are ways of doing that. SL?
Well, whatever language theosophy would be expressed in would not be perfect, because language itself is but a symbol, a representation of the truth behind it. So if we want to know that truth directly, we have to elevate our thought and mind to the level of that concept or idea. And the only way we can do that is through study, which is not just memorization, but it's investigation, thinking it over, trying to figure it out, making correspondences and analogies to ourselves and other things, comparing different things, and also studying ourselves. And it is through that discipline that slowly we raise the mind to a direct perception of brotherhood, of the truth. They're both in the same thing. One reason why the objectives of the Theosophical movement, and as well as ULT, are directed to so much study of metaphysics, philosophy, ethics, psychology, but remembering always that we have to put that into practice.
Yes, and even if the mind is not willing sometimes, the heart is. So, you know, the heart doctrine and the head doctrine, so that we need to find what touches us. What is it that we need? Why did we turn from the religions of our childhood? You know, why have we found our way to theosophy? What are we searching for? Truth? ULT?
We have a hand in the hall here.
As regards that second object, which is the study of sciences, religions, and ancient philosophies and all this, to the person of today, if they're interested in anything like theosophy, that kind of makes sense that we should, we'll probably learn a lot if we put a lot of effort into that. But the teachings take it to a whole nother level, because the subtitle of the secret doctrine is what? It's the synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. And a lot of folks would say, well, wait a minute, that's kind of like saying they're all the same. How could we investigate together what it means to recognize that there is a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy?
What is this synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy? Well, it's theosophy. It's found in the secret doctrine. But we as human beings have taken up Aristotle or Aristotelian thinking, and we departmentalize everything. Well, Plato took us from the universals, but we start there and go and we find the particular, and we go back to the universal. So if we want to synthesize anything, what is the universal idea behind philosophy, religion, science? It's to know the unknown. And all of they are is an expression of harmony. Music is harmony, and numbers is harmony, and geometry is harmony. And we as human beings are just realizing that we are the propagators of that harmony, or the disruptors of that harmony, so that the full responsibility for where we are doesn't lie with anyone else but ourselves. So we take out the middleman.
There's a follow-up, please.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting to see it from that perspective, because what very often we see in the world is a person of a particular religion will often denounce any other religion. A highly acclaimed scientist in his public life is not going to get into the nature of God because he'll be academically decapitated. Other scientists aren't going to have it. And there are just so many ways of, there are so many different philosophies. It kind of depends on what culture you're brought up in. So it just seems like everything is trying to separate itself from everyone else. Maybe it has to do with theosophy helps us discern the false ideas in religion or the false notions of sciences. And with whatever truth we have left, we might be able to see that a lot more of these departments really can be seen as one.
So how do we help our brother and sister scientists? And afterwards, if no one else raises their hand, we have another hand in the hall. Thank you.
Well, I think we're all saying the same thing. That the unity of theosophy, it's the root or the rootless root of all knowledge, that everything goes back to us, as said before, that point in the circle. Everything goes back to that. So there is a unity that exists that we have, that we ignore. And theosophy tries to tell us that ride that wave of that unity. Once you begin studying theosophy, you start expanding your mind, your consciousness, whether you want to or not. Because, reincarnation, karma, the origin of man, we are rays of light. We have evolved from gods or from spirit into matter. All these ideas, once they are, what we would say, digested by us mentally, they change us because we can no longer go back, because we have heard the truth and we can no longer be one of the herd that follows what the masses believe. So, yes.
We have another comment now?
Yeah.
In the back?
Yes, one of the things that we find interesting in regards
to— Can you hear this? Or does it speak up, please?
One of the ideas with this unity in diversity and diversity in unity that we're looking at with science, religion, and philosophy is that there's a basis and that theosophy is putting forth, that there is a basis for those three ideas. And if one looked like we've been studying on our Sunday classes about how the ancient philosophers brought forth these ideas that are now, that are the same. It's the truth, because truth is the same no matter when it's put forth. So we need to understand that these three ideas all have the same origin. And that origin is that one deific principle.
Did she come across loud and clear?
Yep. Yes, she did.
Okay.
That one, that one principle, which we are all the source of, that unknown, and from everything has come forth. That point in the circle. Yes, SL.
In the beginning of the meeting, it was mentioned that there was going to be some type of connection between the three objects and the three fundamental principles, or the truths that underlie all great philosophies and religions. So it seems that those three objects are applications of the true ideas, eternal, we might say eternal verities, universal truths.
Yes, I mean, we think that we keep on using the terms analogy and correspondence, which is a skill which our modern society has long abandoned. But theosophy tells us this is the best way for us to understand many of the things that we talk about in theosophy, and that the idea that this forming of a nucleus of a universal brotherhood is really corresponds and is an analogy for that which is unknown, that is the source of all, that one unifying principle. So that we are given these ideas and saying, oh, here, you have the truth. It doesn't, these ideas, you can come to these classes week after week and week after year after year. We're not going to teach you anything. We're going to expose you to some of these ideas. And if you wish to investigate and you wish to, you know, to find out the truth, we hope we can help, because it's all through self-realization. If you don't realize it, it's not true anymore. It's not the truth to you. If you're going to just accept it on blind faith, it's not going to be rooted in your heart. One day something will happen and it'll change. Yes, ELT.
During the talk, the word occultism was mentioned, and it was going into a little bit. We were just wondering if we could have some more discussion about the word occultism or occult, because it scares a lot of people. It's something that we've been told is, well, it's evil, but is it evil really, or is it just that which is hidden? And if it is that which is hidden, where do we find it?
Where do we find it? Well, look within. Thou art Buddha.
I'm looking.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, don't get lost in the darkness.
I'm lost still too. Yeah.
No, we're all trying to get out of the darkness, and that little light that shines, we are all trying to walk toward it. And you know, in that darkness, we have placed a lot of obstacles in our way, but no one's fault but our own. SL?
Well, we think we have an interesting chat contribution which contributes to this idea of the occult. So it says, truth is subjective and it is hidden. And the same thing could be said of what is a cult? Cult means, of course, what is hidden. But what is a cult may seem subjective to us from our physical senses. But from the perspective of our spiritual and inner senses, the truth perceived is objective. It's as real as the laws we observed on this physical plane. So the occult has to do with the direct knowledge or perception of those underlying truths or laws or principles that are normally hidden from our view.
Yes, that. The occult is that unseen world. You know, which is talked about in theosophy quite extensively, because science only talks about which is seen. You know, and the occult is that which is unseen. And I think the chat goes, it scares many people because they think it's a devil worship. Well, that unseen is the imagination. You know, the imagination has to be trained. And that these superstition and these ideas that are implanted in man's psyche through religion and other means is that we are evil and that evil exists. Well, we are not evil, but we do evil things sometimes. That the occult is the use of those unseen powers that exist in all of us. And we use them now, but we are not aware of it. SL?
Well, we have here a chat that the simple word occult scares many, devil worship. Well, the idea of Satan wasn't always the devil or the evil one. Initially, he was the adversary. He was even called Lucifer initially, the light bringer. And in Revelations, or rather in Job, he's sort of like the companion of God. He is the tool of God in checking out Job's real devotion. So as we understand it, the devil really, as we understand it today, the evil, didn't really develop until the Middle Ages. So how did that devil idea, the evil, get to be associated with the occult? How was that connection made? Unmute.
You know, the occult conjures up ideas for the most of humanity, but the truth, the occult brings about the use of these unseen powers. You know, speech is an unseen power, but a thought is also an unseen power, and that the mind is the generator of all these forces. So that if the mind is taken off its true purpose and diverted to on this plane, it's opposite. Light is darkness, you know, so that the occult brings up this dichotomy, you know, the seen and the unseen, the light and the darkness, and that there is, we would think that there's the motivation or the drive of all of this is selfishness, and that the darkness lies in that selfishness, that extreme separateness that is adhered to by many who have garnered wealth, power, and privilege. We see it there most blatantly, but in the secret recesses of our heart, it also exists, a feeling separate from the mass of humanity. JCS?
Well, if we get back to the question of what happened during the Middle Ages, at a period of time in the Western world, in the Europe only, where the image, the symbolism of Lucifer was perverted and twisted, what we can study is a whole course of history where thought among the masses is not allowed to be free, where the true nature of self and that independent power and potential of each individual is squashed. And you can look into the rise of empires in Europe, the rise of a church hierarchy that had more to do with military and political power, might, than religious philosophy. And in all cases, when you start to look at these practices, what they're actually squashing is independent thought, is the reality of each individual soul one to one, equal to the other, without any distinctions of class and culture and wealth and race and sex, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the occult became painted as this evil in order to be controlled by the political, military, and church hierarchies. And it went from the Middle Ages on. Easy to study through the course of history.
Yes. Yes, that was a very helpful hint. ULT?
Another hand in the hall here.
Yes, we'd like to contribute to that. You know, so occultism in the West, it's not brand new. It was anciently known right up through those first couple centuries AD when the church was growing in power. And the church knew all of this. And in the ancient times, it was recognized, the power of the occult and the danger of it. So it was only certain people who were initiated by showing their ethics and their morality who would be taught these principles. Well, when the church came to power, they forbade people from investigating anything into the occult and said it was an investigation of Satan. So that being said, today, the word occult means something so different today. And it's unfortunate because whether we realize it or not, an individual who personally makes the decision to shed himself of certain emotional patterns because he knows that it's not good for him, if he makes the effort to redirect his emotions and his mind and thereby raises his own nature and becomes a more loving person, that is an occult thing. It's on occult planes. Nobody else knows it while it's going on, but they can see the outward effect of it as he grows. That's all occult. And that's the occult that theosophy is talking about.
SL?
In the light of the chat here, how do you present the philosophy of theosophy to the people that struggle daily to meet basic needs such as food and shelter? Where does practical charity along those lines in terms of helping the basic needs of people as we find it fit in with the three objects of the theosophical movement?
Helping to fulfill a basic need of humanity, and there are many. There's an old saying, if a hungry man comes to your door begging for food, don't send the help to the door to give him food. You go and you do it yourself. And that one's attitude is really the foundation upon which we perceive life and its trials and tribulations. We are always encouraged to be positive and to find the positive meaning to what is happening. Now, if you can't find a shelter or food, you're in desperate need of help. SL?
Well, the first object would extend it even further than that. It would say, if a hungry snake appears at your door, do you stamp it out? Do you kill it? Or do you put out some food for it to eat?
Yeah.
So it's not just a matter of what's your attitude towards a neighbor or a friend or a harmless person, but what's your attitude towards someone you perceive to be dangerous or your enemy or in a condition contrary to what you value? How do you approach them? And that's where philosophy and discipline become very important.
Yes, it becomes very important. That when we are repelled by something, we have to look within our own nature, not into the other. What is it that is making us, you know, react in such a way? Yes, JCS.
There's wonderful portions of the Key to Theosophy. The back of the book has a series of addendums about charity and political reform and education. And ULT is known for independence of effort. So the invitation is for us to come together as this morning, as a point in a circle, to generate thought, and then to have a ripple effect as we go out into our daily lives across the week, to individually, by conscience and intuition, find those opportunities in our daily lives to alleviate the suffering of another, to pursue charitable efforts, to pursue reform movements. But it's not under, there's no organizational ULT that does that. Rather, each of us is invited to take these ideas that are abstract and then apply them and make them real as we work to promote universal brotherhood. And that has a connotation of fulfilling the needs of every single human being within our sphere of influence, empowering the others to be able to help themselves.
Well put. Well put indeed. We hope you have found these ideas helpful, and that, as was said, that we will take them into the week and try to apply them. But I must say that the ULT in Philadelphia is sustained through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. Now, a few are seen, but you're all invited to participate, and we bid you a good week.